Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome to another hour dedicated to a fresh inquiry, exploring exactly what enlightenment means and what it just might be to be enlightened. Indeed, an hour devoted to learning something more about ourselves, an hour designed to help us integrate all of our knowledge and perhaps even challenge some of our ideas about the world we live in and the people we have become. This is an hour for the open-minded, willing to risk their foregone conclusions and perhaps discover an entirely new dimension in their thoughts and being. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right. If you're not already in our chat room, we invite you to go there now and join the excellent group that always adds so much to our show. You can log on by going to Eldon Taylor, ELDONTAYLOR.com/chat. Ravinder is there to welcome you and see that your comments and questions do get on the air. Okay, Rav, time for your line. Say hello to everyone.
Hi, everyone. And, of course, do come join us in the chat room. We have an amazing group of people in there and an amazing pool of talent in there. So if you've got questions, someone in there will have an answer for you. Join us at eldontaylor.com/chat and come say hi.
Now, each week, I read a few of your letters as our way of recognizing the importance you play in shaping and improving our show. Last week, our discussion was all about resolution solutions. We provided some tips and tools. Indeed, we gave away a couple of $1,000 of InnerTalk programs to assist and facilitate many with their goals and ambitions. Monica wrote, "Thank you for the show. It was magnificent." Evelyn wrote, "Enjoy the show. I have had success with InnerTalk, and I'm treating myself to some new ones for the new year. I love your products because I know they work. Your show is excellent. I can't believe the number of people you were able to help in that hour." And in a separate comment, Ravinder, Evelyn added, "Rav, great to hear your voice." You know, lots of folks are talking to me about how good it is to hear your voice and something's going on with your voice, how it's a new voice. Are you going to share with everyone the story behind your new voice?
Not today. Not today. I'll keep everyone in suspense. I am working on it every moment. And when the time comes to reveal my secret, I'll even let you do a whole show on it.
All right. Cool. you'll want to catch that show, I guarantee you. Marcel wrote, "I have been using InnerTalk for years, and they have always been 100% successful every time." Danny wrote, "I enjoy your show on Hay House Radio." We're glad you do, Danny. Michael wrote, "I featured your book, Mind Programming, in a class on the media, which I taught for adult education at California State University, San Bernardino." Well, thank you, Michael. Everyone, in my view, needs to be informed about the manipulation methods employed every day in the media, especially in an election year. The propaganda is now easing out of every nook and cranny, but soon it will pour out like a West African monsoon, and many will rush to swallow their favorite sound bites, irrespective of the truth or the full story. It's a time for label makers to define and redefine, indeed to sculpt beliefs and expectations. And then when one stands back because it's not working and they don't understand why, well, another invented reason will suddenly appear, and off many will go with that as though it were the truth. So, I'm glad you're using mind programming, Michael, and I suggest it to everyone. Jennifer wrote, "Hi, Eldon. I am a new customer of InnerTalk for about a month now. I started with the free audio tracks and within 2 weeks woke up every day full of hope and a firm belief that each day has meaning and good intentions. I have since ordered 5 different tracks. I am astounded. I read your newsletter in which you discussed the events expected for 2012. I agree wholeheartedly with your predictions and beliefs. It is our attitudes that will change the world." Well, now, first, thank you for your letter, Jennifer. And second, for all of you, if you've not visited my website and downloaded your free MP3 InnerTalk program or programs, then I have to ask you, why not? All you need to do is visit InnerTalk.com or EldonTaylor.com and choose free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. It's that simple. Now, one more thing. While you're there, be sure to sign up for my free InTouch newsletter. Ruth wrote, I am a life coach and I have benefited greatly from InterTalk. I also recommend it to my clients. Thank you, Ruth. Lisa wrote, thank you for your CDs. I used Freedom from Sugar and after 10 days I no longer crave sweets. And now I don't really even stop to notice the desserts and cakes when I am in the grocery store. I just walk on by. Well, now I like that. You remember that song, Walk On By? Congrats, Lisa. It's really that easy, and we're thrilled for your success. And Shelley wrote, thanks so much for your Hay House radio show. I have learned so much this past year by listening to your show. It's the best. Wow. Thank you, Shelley. And we'll do our very best to live up to those words. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. You can also just leave comments on my website. I do try to read all of your letters. Obviously, we can't get them all on the air, but they do impact our programming, and I highly value your input. So I do encourage you to please provide your feedback, and once again, thank you for your continued support. Now to today's show. The poltergeist phenomenon. What exactly is a poltergeist? Now, this is a German term that translates roughly to mean something like noisy ghost. Parapsychologists often refer to the phenomenon using the rather unwieldy term recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. You know, a poltergeist is present when objects begin to fly about the room, tables rise and slam down against the floor. Drawers open and slam shut, cupboards, doors, well, they nearly fly off their hinges and so forth. It's assumed that the poltergeist enters into this activity with some malevolent or mischievous intent. In other words, unexplained physical manifestations are occurring in plain view, and they appear to be threatening. Now, there's nothing new about poltergeists. We have written records of so-called noisy spirits throughout history. One such account became a famous movie called The Entity. The movie was purportedly based on the paranormal events a woman and her family experienced circa 1976. Barbara Hershey starred in this film as a woman tormented by an unseen entity that would not only throw objects, but could throw her down, and indeed did so, forcibly and repeatedly raped her. Now, again, purportedly, a team of university researchers who were supposed to rid the woman of the poltergeist witnessed all of this. Film footage was supposedly shot of some of the activity, verifying the event to be more than the woman's imagination, and it was not uncommon for an attack to leave her badly bruised. Now, throughout history, many reliable sources have attested to witnessing poltergeist activity. Some believe the poltergeist is the work of Satan. Some have argued that it is nothing more than psychokinesis, mind, moving matter. And many charge that it is all a great hoax and or the result of natural effects such as downdrafts from a fireplace, vibrations that are unheard, and so forth. However, the Skeptics Dictionary, which typically is rather abrasive towards matters of this nature, seems to give it some credibility. Now, we have had some wonderful guests in the past that have indirectly spoken about poltergeists in the literal sense of the definition. For example, Michael Tim shared the story of two famous sisters who heard rapping coming from the wall of their bedroom. In time, they worked out a code and began communicating with the rapping by rapping back. They learned of a body that was hidden in the walls, and sure enough, law enforcement recovered the body. As the sisters, who became prominent mediums, tell the story, the rapping was coming from the spirit of the murder victim. Okay, rapping is itself characteristic of poltergeist activity, so we don't have to get to the wild and weird as depicted in the movies by that title to have a poltergeist present. Our guest today is award-winning investigative reporter Michael Clarkson. He has reviewed 75 cases and interviewed hundreds of witnesses, paranormal experts, law enforcement officers, psychologists, and skeptics to come up with some eye-opening results. Michael Clarkson is a nonfiction author and a professional speaker who has spent 37 years as a print journalist, winning numerous awards for his investigative pieces, including the Canadian National Newspaper Award twice. As a police reporter, he was twice nominated for the Michener Award, for public service in Canada, and in 1980, he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his story about reclusive author J.D. Salinger, who he met twice in New Hampshire. Clarkson has also been a sports reporter, interviewing famous athletes such as the basketball legend Michael Jordan and the golfer Tiger Woods. Three of Clarkson's books are on fear. Excuse me. I've got a frog in my throat here. Three of these books are on fear: competitive fear, intelligent fear, and quick fixes of everyday fears, which have been published in the United States, Canada, and in Europe. Today we'll be speaking about his 2011 release, The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. So let's get him in here and get him to talking so I can clear this throat. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Mr. Michael Clarkson.
Thanks, Eldon. I think you got a poltergeist there in your esophagus.
Yeah, it seems like somebody just visited me. That's a fact. I like that.
Yeah.
Let's begin by starting from the beginning. You've obviously cleared that poltergeist. Thank you. How and why did you become interested in the paranormal?
I guess, Eldon, a number of things. A curiosity. I've always been interested in the subjects that other people wouldn't touch. More specifically, in 1980, a young man came around to my house after I'd done a Halloween story relating to him without naming him. And he told me of this case he had 10 years earlier where there were a whole shift, in fact, two shifts of police officers attended this boy's house when he was 11 years old and swore to the fact that when the boy was in the room, mysterious energies would come to play, and things like chairs, even beds, would lift up off the floor while the police were there. So I sort of stored that away, being I was a police reporter at the time. And I stored that away for about 10 years and then started collecting poltergeist cases through the media, and wondered what would happen if I studied these more closely and came up with a book. So, I think it's an interesting subject. That's what a compelling subject, which got my curiosity to the point, Eldon, that I let this develop, I guess, for about 30 years before, while last year I sat down and wrote a book about it.
Okay, now I'm going to have to ask you this, because the book is completely out of the gender of what you typically do. And getting into dealing with poltergeists is something, I guess when I look at it, I think of the movies and I think of the hoaxes that I know of and so on and so forth. So I'm going to ask you right up front, Mike. Are poltergeists real, or is it a matter of some other explanation, in your view?
Well, my view, Eldon, after studying these 75 cases, I think that the poltergeist activity seems to be real. There, besides the two shifts of police officers in 1970, I came up with another number of police officers throughout the world, and about, I think there was more than 20 of them. Actually, there was 51 if you include Europe. In 17 cases, we have 51 cops who are saying poltergeist activity, as you say, or question, is real, to the point that they went back to their police station and wrote out reports on them. Now, I don't know if you know cops as well as I do, Eldon, but they don't want to be ridiculed. And obviously, with dabbing into this subject, it leaves themselves wide open for ridicule back at the cop shop when they talk about things moving without the help of human hands. So, yes, I do think poltergeist activity is real. I think we're just starting now, though, to get a better understanding of it. And as you so eloquently read or said early on, you went through, I think, all the theories about poltergeist. I think it has more to do with, you mentioned my books are not related, but they are in a little way, because I think it's got a lot to do with the fear system. In other words, I think what we're dealing here with, Eldon, is haunted people rather than haunted homes. I think the energy force, albeit very unusual and rare, is coming from the people themselves, most often young people.
You know, now a couple of things, Michael. First of all, I have some familiarity with law enforcement since I was involved in it for many years as a lie detection examiner.
Wow.
And I do know that, you know, you're absolutely right. The last thing that you're going to do is step forward and say there was a ghost in the room. This is, and you're not going to put it in a written report, period. But with that said, you know, our audience should also know that one of the real values to this is law enforcement that you're talking about that observed these issues is not just that they're typically very conservative about matters of this nature, but that they're also trained observers.
Yes.
They're trained. You know, law enforcement learns very quickly to get detail. You know, one of the things that I did was, you know, debrief witnesses often, and you could have three people that witnessed an armed robbery, and they would have three different physical descriptions for the perpetrator.
Yes.
And they would be diverse as 6 foot tall and black and 5 foot two and white.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you sometimes could. But law enforcement is trained to really look at detail, to pay close attention. So when you say you had that many law enforcement officers say, that's pretty compelling to me. I have to admit that. You know, the second thing in this is, you know, one of the chapters in your book deals with a very specific case having to do with law enforcement, and I'll get to that in a minute. But you heard the setup piece. If this is, you know, something that, as you would say, is a part of the individual, the consciousness of the individual, as opposed to subject to the house, and there are many theories that approach that. I'll ask you about that in a minute. How would you take, or what would you take out of the story that surrounds the entity? Are you, and I guess you're familiar with that, are you not, Michael?
Yes. I don't think we can prove that one, Eldon. I know it's a very sexy story, and I think it came out of a case in Maryland, if I'm not mistaken, in the late 40s, and Hollywood grabbed it. And my theory is that they went for entertainment value. I don't know how much of the entity was really based on fact. I think when you get a script in the hands of Hollywood scriptwriters and they run with it, I don't know what's left. But it's possible that case was a possession case. My 75 cases do not really involve any possession cases, so I didn't look at the entity that closely. But I do know that I'm quite skeptical of anything on the screen which involves poltergeist. In other words, the movie series, not the screen series, of Poltergeist seems to be based on just entertainment value. I don't see any connection at all with haunted people. Rather, in the first Poltergeist movie, I think we had an Indian burial site under the house. Now, that may have been true. I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is, I guess I've narrowed my definition of the term poltergeist. There may be ghosts involved in knocking noises. There may be entities involved. But by and large, in these 75 cases, I think we're dealing with some very unusual people.
Okay, but all right. With that said, we'll get to some details here. Do you believe then that the poltergeist is capable of manhandling a person, injuring a person, leaving bruises on a person?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier about the mischievous intent. Well, I found in these cases that there was indeed a mischievous intent in many cases rather than a downright malevolent intent, although I did find about a dozen people had been injured when dealing with poltergeists, but none of them seriously. I think sometimes they may have been indirectly injured. In other words, let's go back to that case in 1970 with the cops. If there were things flying around the room, I don't think that the poltergeist energy was necessarily directed at that person, but because they were in the path of flying furniture, then they got hurt. But I don't think there was a reported case of someone actually being murdered by a poltergeist years ago, but I checked and checked for that, and I just couldn't find any basis for it.
Okay, now, you set out several reasons in your book that skeptics view as the reasons that undergird why people believe in poltergeists. And believe I believe you more or less quote Michael Shermer, and the founder of Skeptic Magazine, in doing so. Share with us what those reasons are that give rise to why, you know, most people, according to skeptics, would believe in poltergeists.
I think it's a historical issue here, Eldon. I think you mentioned that term earlier, noisy ghost. And I think we've gotten too attached to that. I think hundreds of years ago, maybe we believed in such things as noisy ghosts, and there still may be noisy ghosts, but I think poltergeist is more specific than that. I'm not sure what to say about what people believe. I know a lot of these beliefs in the supernatural and poltergeist are quite cultural and historical. People are brought up in a certain mindset, and they tend to force their theories into any subject, whether it's possession, whether it's ghosts, or whether it's poltergeist. And in that regard, I tried to come to this, as Michael Shermer, tried to come to this with a neutral mindset. It's not always possible. Of course, we all have our biases. But I know that everyone does have their own interpretation of poltergeist, and mine comes from these 75 cases.
Okay. I guess what I'm trying to get to here, because I see you, I've looked at your material, I see you as a conservative reporter who has done some really solid work, and now you're writing about poltergeist, and having come from a community where I respect that conservative view, and I have also put myself at risk by making statements or investigating material that community would prefer to invalidate.
Yes.
Where I'm going is, I know that you're going to be confronted with, you know, the notions that people want to believe this because it's consistent with their need to believe in a higher power, that they manifest these things, that their interpretation of natural events is supernatural, just as and they do so as automatic as they anthropomorphize the intelligence of their pet dog and so on and so forth. So you must have had some of that criticism leveled at you in your work. And how did you handle it?
Sure. Well, I actually, in a case like this, a book like this, Eldon, I get it from both sides. In other words, I will hear from a group of people who say, forget the haunted people. This is all about ghosts, because they believe that way. Then from the other side, the more scientific side, I guess, too scientific, I think, I get people who are saying, well, you know, Clarkson, you've done some good work in the past, investigative stuff, but why the hell are you doing a book on poltergeist? You're going to lose your credibility. And in fact, I've had at least one reviewer, probably I think more than one, say exactly that. Now, how do I deal with that? I think it's just from being an investigator, Eldon, over the years, when I'm involved, let's take police, for example. When I'm constantly doing police stories, I'm always getting hit from both sides. There's always two sides to a story, but you hear from the people who have their angle. So you just have to develop a thick skin and keep going forward. That's not to say I dismiss other people's theories, but what I'm saying is that I try to come into this with a open frame of mind, and I'm trying to stick closely to the 75 cases I have reviewed and the results of them rather than any preconceived ideas of myself or of other people when they come to the subject.
All right. Well, we're coming up on a hard break, and in this next half hour, we're going to take on those 75 cases, because the book is a phenomenal book. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Provocative Enlightenment on Hay House Radio. We have a film for you in the chat room, so if you're not already in there, you need to get in there and take a look at it. This film takes a look at poltergeist phenomena, particularly on YouTube, and it's a bit of a debunker. It may assist you in the second half of the show. The book by Michael Clarkston is The Poltergeist Phenomena, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. You want to read this one. Stay with us during the break. You won't want to miss what's coming up. We'll be right back after these words from our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're discussing the Poltergeist Phenomena with author Michael Clarkson. And I think Michael chased the poltergeist away. It was stealing my voice in the first half of the hour, but first half hour, I should say. But I seem to have it back now. But before we get back to today's show, I want to invite you to like our Facebook fan page for Provocative Enlightenment Radio. As a fan of the show, you'll receive special announcements and incentives from time to time as our way of thanking you for your support. I would also like to invite you to join me on Facebook while you're there, and of course you can follow me on Twitter. If you like our show, please do spread the word. We genuinely appreciate your support. All right, before the break, we introduced the idea of just honing in more specifically on 75 cases that Michael did his research on, that the book The Poltergeist Phenomenon is based around. And again, this is a great book. You're going to want to read this book. You're going to want to look at this case evidence, because when you're all said and done with it, as skeptical as you might be, I think you're going to come down on, you know, you just can't dismiss it all. But I don't want to predispose that too much. However, Michael, before we jump into your 75 cases, I have to ask you about a recent famous case, the Enfield Poltergeist. You're familiar with that one, are you not?
Yes, I've got a couple of chapters in my book on that.
Yeah, and tell me, what is it that you think about the Enfield Poltergeist? Is this a, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, comments out there that say this was a hoax. Where do you come down on it?
I think, Ellen, this is a complex case which fits a category I call when the circus comes to town. In other words, we may have a legitimate poltergeist case on our hands, but and usually, maybe later on we'll get into this, that it usually involves young people. I can go a little further with how and why. But when young people are involved and they are the so-called entity, let's say, of the case, and things are happening legitimately, but in most poltergeist cases I've found, the energy dissipates after 2-3 weeks. So when the circus comes to town is the media. When the media comes into a home because they've heard about this legitimate so-called poltergeist activity, children, being children or adolescents, they like attention. So they're getting attention because they're making things perhaps move with their mind. Now, if it dissipates during the media coverage, then they tend to cheat. And I think that's what we have here in Enfield. I think in London we had a case where it seemed to be legitimate activity in the beginning, but it dragged on for so long, more than a year, which is very unusual in poltergeist cases, that the two young girls involved in the case, I believe, in fact, they admitted they were making things move when people weren't watching with their hands. So in a number of these cases, we have this circus comes to town syndrome when we're dealing with young people who want attention and they want to keep attention, whether it's by hook or by crook.
That's kind of what happened with the so-called Columbus poltergeist in 1984. I mean, my understanding is a TV crew left a camera running inadvertently, and they detected that this young girl was indeed causing things to move. However, did she cause everything to move, or was she just, as you say, acting out for additional attention? I know you have a chapter in the book where you deal with James Randi, and of course Randi's challenge, and you know, I think Randi's position on poltergeist is it's absolute nonsense, period, end of quotation. And he happens to use cases like the Enfield and the Columbus poltergeist as evidence that it's manipulated. When you look at it, are you persuaded at all by the fact that if there is some fakery, it is all fakery, or do you really have the ability to say, well, I think this child just got involved in an attention-seeking mechanism?
I think you have to look at everything. You have to step back, which obviously the amazing Randi, as he calls himself, does not do. He came into that poltergeist case with already his mind made up. In fact, he said that before he interviewed anybody in the case. He showed up to rant and rave, I think. And so he had his mind up, made up, as you say, that poltergeists simply don't exist. He equates it to like he's been waiting all these years, a Christmas morning, for Santa to drop down the chimney, and Santa hasn't arrived yet. But I tend not to throw out the baby with the bathwater when I find fraud in cases. And in fact, I have a whole chapter on fraud. There are some cases, Ellen, where it's just downright fraud, and no psychokinesis or no haunted people, no amazing energies at all. But just to finish the book on Amazing Randy, he started out, I think he's got a lot of good things to say, and I'm all for being conservative and, you know, testing, but he's become, I think, a cynical. He's a cynic. He's not a skeptic anymore. In fact, in this Columbus case you mentioned, I contacted him, not at the time, years later, and asked him for if he wanted to be interviewed, please, and research, look at my 75 cases. And no, he just gave me a carte blanche. Poltergeists don't exist. You didn't see it. I wasn't there. You weren't there, so it didn't exist. So I think a chap like the Amazing Randy, initially, I think they do a good service, but I think he gets caught up in his own hype, and he shows up with a cape, and he's part of the entertainment factor I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, he is the media circus himself, or at least that's what he seeks. Okay, I will concur with you that at least initially we need people that are honest questioners. Skeptic is okay with me if we think of that as the skeptics of Greece. But we don't need people that are just, as you say, cynics, and there are plenty of those out there that would debunk anything that would attach itself to paranormal.
Yeah.
So with that said, you introduced the idea, and I want to follow it because it's also popular in the movies. And it does seem to, there seems to be a very high correspondence between poltergeist phenomena, the manifestation, you know, and children. What is that all about?
There are a number of common denominators, Alvin, in the when I was reviewing these 75 cases, and one of them was it seems to be more prevalent among youngsters. Usually they're above average in intelligence, like the one who came to my house in 1980, and there are some people who have a theory that is related to puberty, that there is an unusual energy force which manifests itself when a child is going through or just gone through puberty. But I think this subject, Alvin, is so complex. I think that's just one of the things I found. I can list these other common denominators right now if you want and go into the...
Yeah, please do.
Sure. Usually the poltergeist agent, as we'll call them, because of these cases, I believe, as I said, it comes from the person, and the person is the agent. A poltergeist agent is usually an adolescent entering puberty around whom the strange activities occur. Secondly, there's usually some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent or the child by others in the house, which leads to a high level of stress in the house prior to the start of the poltergeist activity and continuing through the case. I think this is somewhat related to fear, and what I call fear energy. We can talk about that a little more, and we all have fear energy. But just to close this out, as I said earlier, one of the denominators is that most of these cases only have a lifespan of 1 week to several months, the case in Enfield, London being the exception. Dramatic events are very common, such as unexplained knocking, electrical malfunctions, movement of objects and furniture. Occasionally reported in 75 cases were levitation of objects, electrical appliances working without power, and very rarely stones falling apparently from nowhere. Rarely reported, again in my narrow definition of poltergeist, are strange voices coming from the agent. Apparitions, strange odors, cold spots, or water formings. Although in the Enfield case, that was one thing that was reported was strange voices coming from not only one, but it turned out two of these girls ended up being the poltergeist agent. But that is the one area where they said they had cheated in that coming up with these voices that people thought were from possession. And the final final common denominator, Ellen, we've already talked about that, is the mischievous intent on the part of the agent rather than the malevolent one.
You know, all of that sets itself up to suggest a psychological root to the problem and a manifestation that could be PK in its nature as opposed to spirit inhabited in its nature. Do you think both things go on, Michael?
Well, I think only about 5% of the cases my book seem to involve ghosts and indirect poltergeist activity. Now, yes, you're right. I think it seems to be closer to, in general, PK or psychokinesis, but more specifically, you mentioned this term earlier, RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. Right. And it seems to be at work in most of these cases, you know, the bizarre movements of objects, etc. But that leads to a question of how the heck do they do it? If these teenagers, adolescents, are making things move with their mind, it's easy to say, well, they just use psychokinesis, but how do you do that? Well, right. I found a number of common denominators, again, on how they do it. It seems as though poltergeist agents may be, their brains may be unique. There's a slightly higher rate of epilepsy, for example, in schizophrenia and poltergeist cases. There was one, the late parapsychologist from London, Andrew Green, he said some of the agents suffered from a front temporal lobe epilepsy. Now, that's a brain disorder in which people can suffer blackouts lasting from a minute to about a half an hour. And during these blackouts, he said, an unknown power of the mind may be released, which can cause objects to move. I've also found, Eldon, that there seems to be tapping into local sources of energy. They may be doing it through psychokinesis, but I think there's usually a nearby source of energy, whether it's electricity in the house. There may be geomagnetic storms outside, magnetic fields, or energy from the mind-body. I think sometimes we forget that until we walk on the carpet and zap ourselves on the doorknob, we forget that our own bodies seem to have electrical energy. So there seems to be it's a complex web, and it's very easy to simplify it, and that's why I'm very thankful that you've given me an hour to do so. But the other component I mentioned was fear energy. I studied the body's fight or flight system, and one of the unusual, let's say, talents of the body's fight or flight system, we all have the fight or flight, of course, is a manifestation of things which are mental, psychological, or emotional. And whenever we feel stressed, like a lot of these kids did in these households, our bodies and our minds, Eldon, go through a whole series of changes. And there are even the obvious ones, of course, are physical. You hear the urban tales about the little old lady picking up the car off her granddaughter who was crying and dying. And I think those cases are documented, and those are easy to establish because they're physical, the adrenaline flowing, the extra power, the extra speed. But there's also another area, and I found a branch of the fight-or-flight system which is referred to as tachypsychia. Now, that's Greek for speed of the mind. And I think probably every member out there in your audience has come up with this or has experienced tachypsychia at least once in their life. And what that is when we are challenged to the utmost, when our lives are threatened, when we're in a serious automobile accident, everything seems to happen in slow motion. You'll hear this also from athletes under great stress. The basket seemed bigger. The action seemed to move in slow motion. Well, I think it's real. I think it does happen. What happening there is, Eldon, our body in a frightful situation goes into almost like a camera on fast forward. Things aren't happening any slower, but our mind gives us the action one frame at a time in order that we can more easily deal with the impending threat. Now, there may be quite a jump from that to how do these people move things with their mind, but I think that is also another strong component. In other words, these poltergeist agents seem to be very finely in tuned with their fight-or-flight system and this so-called tachypsychia.
Right. Okay, well, and that's a good explanation. Thank you, Michael. But with that said, then we have the 5% that would be ghosts.
Sure.
And you know, just today I happened to see a minister who is making a public statement to the world, a priest, that the church invented hell as a control mechanism. And, you know, there are a lot of people that want to think that everything is love, you know, that there is no such thing as evil. Your experience, you have 5% they're ghosts? Is this a malevolent, is this a trapped ghost? I mean, what exactly are we talking about here? It doesn't seem to, I mean, I guess when I look at that, I think that, you know, this conjures up notions of evil.
That may be true, Alden, and I guess it's, again, the interpretation, definition, what you give to poltergeist, but yes, indeed, there are a number of cases in my book. There was a Reverend Colin Grant, not that long ago, but 10 years ago, he conducted an exorcism in the historic Grey Friars Churchyard in Edinburgh, Scotland, after numerous reports of haunting and poltergeist-like occurrences. But the incidents reportedly continue to this day. Now, the one fellow, a parapsychologist by the name of William Roll, who studied more poltergeist cases than anyone, he says he does not know of any case in which a spirit was responsible for a poltergeist incident. However, he said, we should not close our minds to that possibility, but they always seem to occur around a living person. That having been said, I have a number of cases in my book. In March 2010, very recent, a family in Cork City, Ireland, they abandoned their three-bedroom house after reported occurrences over several weeks, which they blamed on evil spirits. Flying ashtrays, glasses, screams in the night, orbs, chairs even hovering in the air, a cooker turning itself off and on. Now, in this particular case, two priests came in. They invited two priests in. It may have been a cultural definition on their part. They may have thought that evil spirits were involved. So when the priests celebrated masses in the home and there was a shaman by the name of Paul O'Halloran, he led an exorcism, but the occurrences continued. Now, O'Halloran believed that three restless ghosts had been caught in a time warp and were haunting the property. I'm going to quote him when he says, the reason they are making so much noise is they want the issue to be sorted out and they want to be freed. I feel the energy is an angry one and needs to be moved on. So whether or not we call that a poltergeist case, it's an interesting case by itself, with several levels. So I'm not dismissing these cases which you refer to me perhaps as being evil. I'm not sure if there is evil out there, but I guess some people's definition is we call other people evil when we stop trying to understand things. It's an easier way of labeling a person or a bad situation is to call them evil. I'm not saying evil doesn't exist, but I don't think it does in at least the 75 cases that I've been reviewing.
All right, good. Now, let's do this then. Of the 75 cases, what you know, share with us a couple that you think are the most compelling.
Sure.
Why? I mean, obviously there had to be something that was the tipping point for you where the reporter inside you, the investigator inside you became the believer.
Yes.
Share that with us.
Well, let's go back to that first case, why I first got involved in St. Catharines. This was 10 years before I became aware of this case. In 1970 in St. Catharines, Ontario, there was a working-class family from a European background living in this upstairs apartment. And there were a number of instances of chairs and beds moving, and they called in the cops. They had no other alternative because the hydro people couldn't find anything wrong with the house, any squeaking of floors, etc. I'm going to read a little bit to you of the logs from the cops. Now, there was Constable Robert Crawford. This was Friday, February 7th, 1970. Crawford found a heavy bed had reportedly been raised 2 feet off the floor by an unseen force. It was reported by a neighbor who told police she had seen it rise off the floor in the boy's bedroom. Crawford rushed into the room and saw the bed approximately 2 feet off the floor on one end, unsupported. Not believing my eyes, he said, I summoned other officers. A couple of days later, for about the 12th time in almost 2 weeks, a constable, Bill Weir, said he saw this boy, I'm going to call him John Mulvey, thrown off a chair. Weir wrote, I attended in the morning and was assisted by another officer. I witnessed some phenomenal occurrences, which I have attached to this report. I proceeded to the residence where we witnessed some very unusual things. Between the time of two calls, I contacted Mr. Bradley, a city building inspector, who agreed that the causes of these weird occurrences was poltergeist and nothing physical in the house. Then, briefly, this boy could not sit on a chair without being thrown off when the police were in the room or items hitting them for no apparent reason. Now, Weir's report was later signed and authorized by his commanding officer, but what Weir did not say in his report was that he himself got the treatment from this unseen force. He told another officer that the poltergeist force picked up a chair he was sitting in, all 220 pounds of him, and tipped him on his ass. Now, Eldon, if little John Mulvey had really done that, 11 years old physically, I think that would be a tough one to explain back to the boys at the cop shop.
Right, unless his grandmother out there lifting the car off the baby, but you're right.
Yes, but unfortunately, in physical cases, I think it's when we see somebody lifting something, we tend to believe it more. But when it's mind over matter, so-called psychokinesis, then it's easier to be skeptical because right. There are a lot of frauds out there.
Absolutely. That is a very convincing case. Was that the most convincing case that you worked on, Michael?
It was it was not well documented. It was very convincing. There was another similar case in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1974 where a bunch of cops, again, one cop in the presence of a 10-year-old girl who seemed to be the agent, and one cop said he saw a 450-pound refrigerator lift off the floor and then set down again. And another officer said, I just couldn't believe what I saw. Shelves fixed to the wall began to vibrate until they were loose, then flew through the air. I looked for evidence that someone was making it happen, but I couldn't find anything, no wires, no nothing. And this comes back, Eldon, to something you said earlier. Yes, police officers are. They're trained to be not only good witnesses, they're trained to watch out for fraud when the action is happening fast. In other words, they were watching this 10-year-old girl. In the other case, they were closely watching this 11-year-old boy after he or she was always in the room when this happened. So they became skeptical, but when they couldn't find anything on these two young people, then that's when they went back and wrote out a report and said it was a poltergeist.
You know, Michael, you have a recommendation when the audience is interested in following this up. There's two things that comes to my mind. We have a couple of minutes left. The first one is our audience needs to know how to follow up with you, how to reach out, how to connect with you. You've got a website, information of that nature. The second one is your recommendation with regard to better parapsychologists out there to pay attention to, whether it's in their books, their blogs, etc.
Okay. Best way to reach me is www.newpagebooks. That's my publisher.com. They can get more information on me and my books there. I think, I'm not sure your second question, but I think I know that people in poltergeist cases, household members, they're looking for help, whether it's a parapsychologist, whether it's a priest. And I would tell them most cases of it seem to die a natural death. Sometimes the occurrences end when the agent realizes he or she is the cause. Other times psychotherapy seems to help. And if the stress in the family is addressed, whether it's through a parapsychologist, whether it's through a psychologist, then the poltergeist activity seems to dissipate. So I think in many cases, if you just pull the plug on one of these common denominators, which is high stress in the household and repression, then I think you're on your way to getting rid of a so-called destructive poltergeist.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, Michael, we have sincerely appreciated you being here with us today. We have got about 30 seconds. Before we have to close up the show, have you got a last comment you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Sure. I think, as you said earlier, I think people need to come into a complex subject like poltergeist with an open mind. Listen to shows like yours, read books like mine, and try to come to your conclusions at the end and add that to what you already believe. But keep an open mind, I guess, is the major thing.
That's great advice. The book again, The Poltergeist Phenomena, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances by our guest today, Michael Clarkson. All right, we're very happy that you enjoyed us today, and we hope that you enjoyed our show. Until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.